Hello and welcome to this week's Expert HR podcast with me, Jo Thirichalvam. The concept of constructive dismissal continues to flummox employers. Are you confident that you know what the term constructive dismissal actually means? Or that you could explain it to a colleague? Or that you would recognise a constructive dismissal claim that was brewing in your office? Joining me on the phone to demystify the concept of constructive dismissal is Max Winthrop, who is a partner with Short, Richardson & Forth Solicitors. Hi, Max.
Hello.
So, constructive dismissal is a much discussed, much misunderstood concept. So, can you describe it for us in a nutshell?
Yes, it's that situation where an employee is entitled to effectively walk out of his or her job, but still be able to claim that they're the innocent party and can bring a claim, just as if the employer had actually dismissed them.
So that's in a nutshell. There's some key elements to that concept, aren't there?
Yes, very much so. And it's taken the courts and tribunals to evolve this over quite a long period of time, really starting right back in the 70s when the idea of employment rights was comparatively new. So if you break it down, what you've got to have is firstly fundamental breach of contract by the employer. Now that's important because that introduces the idea of the contract as being the key relationship between the parties. Contrast that with unfair dismissal, which is a sort of statutory right all about reasonableness. So this very much harks back to the contract itself. Now I'll look at that in a little bit more detail in a moment.
And this is regardless of whether employer and employee have a written contract.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Just don't forget that a contract simply means in other contexts, is sometimes called the wage work bargain. Somebody agrees to work for an employer for a set wage or salary. That creates a contract. And when we use the word contract, often we're not referring to the written statement of the terms of that contract. Now, for there to be a constructive dismissal, there has to be then a breach of contract. The employee has to resign in response to that breach, and the employee can't wait too long before he or she takes action. Otherwise, the employer will be treated as if they affirmed the contract or waived the breach. These are kind of technical terms from contract law, but they really mean the same thing. If you sit around and just accept what's happened to you, there'll come a point when a court or tribunal will say, well, if you objected to it, you should have gone. You've left it too late.
So can we take the first one of those things that you mentioned, so the fundamental breach of contract committed by the employer? Can you expand on that a little bit for us?
Now, take an easy example to start off with. Supposing the employer doesn't pay the wages. That's a fundamental breach of the contract of employment. The employee would be able to resign in response to that particular breach. Now, there'll be other express terms that the parties have agreed. In those cases, it's usually pretty easy to say, well, clearly, breach of contract, the employee has the option to resign. Where it gets a little difficult, though, is where there isn't an express term in the contract, but you then start getting into the realm of the duty of trust and confidence.
So this is a term that's implied into contracts
that's
of employment.
Right, yes. So what the actual implied term is that the employer would not, without reasonable and proper cause, conduct itself in a manner likely to destroy or seriously damage the relationship of confidence and trust.
So that sounds like it could potentially cover a multitude of sins. So what kinds of things would constitute a breach of the implied term of trust and confidence?
Well, you're right when you say multitude of sins. It does cover a very wide range of conduct. It would look at things like the status of the employee, not an overt kind of demotion, but situation where that status is undermined by when you have a situation where an employer puts in another layer of management above an employee and effectively sidelines another employee. A situation where the employer takes away a benefit that might not be part and parcel of the contract but has been enjoyed for some years. More or less anything that has that effect of undermining the employee can fall within that category. Now, it's important also to remember that that may not necessarily be a kind of short, sharp change. It can be something that's brewing over the years.
Okay, so that's quite an important point, isn't it? So we're not necessarily looking for one dramatic event, but it might be a drip, drip, drip effect.
Very much so. And again, I think if you go back to the earlier cases, that was recognised that there can be a steady pulling away of the rug from someone. It doesn't have to happen all in one go. And the courts have also developed this idea of the last straw. You can look at the events, but then say, oh, well, something happened that was the last straw in that relationship and brought it to an end.
That sort of brings us on quite nicely, actually, to the second element that you mentioned, which is that the employer has to resign in response to the fundamental breach, because that probably, it's kind of a judgment call for the employee, isn't it, in terms of when precisely do they resign?
Yes, we may look at delay later on. But the important point to bear in mind is that the resignation has to be in response to the breach. If you know a little bit about things like unfair dismissal, you might remember that when an employer is having to show the reason for dismissal, the statute talks about the principal reason for dismissal. Well, this is a bit different. Supposing you've got an employee who, after 5 years or so of exemplary service, suddenly finds that her performance reviews are inexplicably poor, that she's not put forward for a bonus, she didn't get the promotion she was expecting. Now, that may be perfectly proper conduct within the terms of the contract of employment, but supposing it's been motivated by some issue, the employee thinks, my line manager's got it in for me and always has, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. Now, if the employee resigns, but waits a little bit until, you know, perhaps a new job comes up. What's the employee resigned? Has she resigned to go to a new job, or has she resigned because of the breach? Well, the courts say it doesn't really matter. You have to answer the question, did the employee resign in response to the employer's breach? And even if there were mixed motives, or there was some other reason for that resignation that might have played a part in it, doesn't matter. It's a response to the breach that's the important issue.
Okay, so that's important. So there has to be a causal connection between the breach and the resignation, but that doesn't discount the fact that there might be other strands of causes that might have been effective in the employee's decision-making process.
Absolutely right, yes.
And I think we've covered the last element, which was the employee not delaying in too long.
If we were in a commercial context, and in a way the terminology here is the same terminology you might have in a civil engineering contract or whatever, but you'll find one big difference between the law when it looks at a commercial relationship between the parties and it looks at the relationship between employer and employee. There's a degree of pragmatism creeps in, and the courts and tribunals will recognise the pressure an employee might be under. If, say, there was a change to the contract of employment, supposing, let's say, the employer decides, instead of having an hour-long lunch break, the employer's strapped for cash, they really need to increase productivity, tells everybody, from next week, your lunch break is reduced to 30 minutes. In a commercial context, that sort of contractual change would require almost an instant response to it to avoid that argument that you've affirmed the contract itself. In the employment field, it's different, and an employee might be given significantly more in terms of latitude in how long they take to respond. In a situation like that, it could be measured in weeks rather than days. Much might depend if the employee was going to say, look, I'm working under protest here, in any event. The courts and tribunals will look at all the circumstances in the round, and they will give the employee a pretty high degree of latitude. And I've come across cases where the employee has sort of thought, should I go, should I stay, should I go, should I stay? And it's taken 6 weeks, 7 weeks before the employee's decided to make a move. The tribunals have said, well, that's fair enough in that context.
So employers probably have to wait for a fair amount of time before they can sort of breathe a sigh of relief in relation to proposed or actual changes.
Now, again, very much dependent upon the facts. If supposing they impose a change, but the employee makes their position very clear, they're working under protest, then it could be a considerable period of time before they can safely assume, if ever, that that contract's been affirmed. If, however, there's no indication of a rejection of the new contract, then that period's going to be a lot shorter. Again, very much dependent on the individual facts.
So you've talked there about fact sensitivity, and that's probably something which is particularly important to constructive dismissal to all of the elements, isn't it?
Absolutely critical. We've got to look at these cases in the context in which they exist, so that what works in one employment relationship might not work in another. There will be different standards of behaviour that I suppose could be said to be acceptable. It's not a completely elastic concept, though. You won't get away, I don't think, in this day and age by saying, oh, well, look, in our industry, we have a standard that kind of demands an autocratic management style. That sort of thing is going to go down like a lead balloon, basically, in most tribunals. It will look at the individual circumstances, but I don't think trying to excuse a management style that might have gone down or been acceptable in the 1950s or 60s, even if you say, oh, we're a football club or an ironworks, Those sorts of arguments, I think, are probably history now.
So that gives us a really useful insight into the concept of constructive dismissal. But if someone goes to tribunal claiming constructive dismissal, things don't end there, do they? So how does an employer defend a constructive dismissal claim in the employment tribunal? Because presumably they will have been arguing that their actions didn't constitute an effective dismissal of the employee. If the employee persuades the employment tribunal that they have been dismissed, employer then has to somehow argue that dismissal was unfair. So how do they do that effectively in their response and their defence generally?
It will vary from case to case. For example, if the argument is one that the employer breached the implied term of trust and confidence, it's going to be very hard for the employer to say, OK, fair enough, I did breach it, but it was fair in all the circumstances. That may not be the case in every constructive dismissal claim. If we go back to our changing the hours of work, if there was a good reason to impose that, and it had been imposed fairly, but perhaps not without the breach of contract, the employer may still be able to say, well, I did have a reason for doing what I did, and therefore my dismissal will be fair, assuming, of course, that it's reasonable in all the circumstances. That's going to be harder in a constructive dismissal claim, but not impossible. However, what you might find is the more common sort of plan B in defending these cases is to say, well, okay, fair enough, yes, we were too quick in imposing this, but we would have had to have done it anyway, and within X number of weeks, we would have had to take the decision, and we would have done it properly, and therefore, instead of this, the compensation being open-ended, it's going to be time-limited, if you like, if you've managed to persuade the tribunal that you would have done whatever it is that the employee is complaining about within a month or so, then that will also have the effect of limiting compensation. There's an interesting little sort of side issue here that everybody was getting excited about a few years back, but I think has now been resolved by the courts and tribunals. There was the beginning of an argument to say, well, hang on a minute, supposing the employee is also in breach for contractual obligations, can they even bring an unfair dismissal claim? At one time, there was some suggestion that in those circumstances, they couldn't do that. That argument's been kicked into touch. Basically, how it works is this. A good example is a case called Atkinson and Community Gateway Association, where Mr. Atkinson was getting up to all sorts of things, unknown to his employer, at least at the time. He seemed to be conducting an affair in breach of the company's own provisions as to its internet policy, which he himself had actually put in place. He was preferring his lover to other job candidates and such like. None of this came out until after his resignation. And the tribunal, when they heard that story, said, OK, we've heard enough. You can't possibly win your claim, Mr. Atkinson. So we're knocking it out at half time. Well, it's a pretty bold thing for the tribunal to do, and perhaps not surprisingly, but when the case was appealed, the Employment Appeal Tribunal said, sorry, you just can't do that. There's no absolute bar on bringing a constructive dismissal claim. However, in those circumstances, even if constructive dismissal had been established, then there would be a reduction for contributory fault. And on the basis of the employee's behaviour in that case, it would have been 100% contributory fault. So that's another example of the plan B in defending these cases. You may have got it wrong in terms of how you've run the contract, but is the employee to blame for what's happened? Can you seek to reduce the damage by arguing for contributory fault?
And that's actually really important, isn't it? Because as much as people tend to focus on liability, the value of the employee's claim obviously affects how much the employer has to pay out. And so it's something which gets neglected probably too often.
I think employment claims are always very personal for everybody involved, whether it's you're involved as the HR officer who may have sanctioned a particular decision-making process, or obviously the employee in that. So everybody wants to kind of vindicate their own position. Sometimes you need to step back a bit and think, well, just a minute, you know, what's really an issue here? What's this really saying in terms of value? Can we justify what we might be spending in terms of management time and legal fees in defending a claim that may be only worth a few hundred pounds?
Just to finish off, presumably most constructive dismissal claims do start off with a complaint or a grievance being lodged. So is it useful for employers to bear that in mind?
Yes, it is. You're going to get some inkling, I would have said, in perhaps 90% of constructive dismissal claims as to what's brewing. There will be a history of grievances, or even if not a formal grievance, the employee is likely to have made their position known. The employee may well be expecting to go through that grievance process rather than simply springing the issue on the employer. It would look odd if the circumstances sprung sort of fully resignation, there'll be some back history so you know what's coming. And of course, the employer can then take appropriate steps, clearly hearing the grievance properly, not jumping to conclusions, investigating where appropriate, is going to be just as important as a constructive dismissal claim as it would be in a claim that might lead to an express dismissal.
I suppose potentially that's the opportunity for the employer to rectify a breach if it perceives that there has been one.
Yes, now be careful here. There's an interesting point about the question of how far can you rectify a breach at all. I think it's illustrated by a case called Bournemouth University in Buckland. What happened in that was that Professor Buckland had issues as to the way in which his marking had been received by the university and begun a sort of series of grievances. When the case got to the EAT, the Employment Appeal Tribunal, the judge there held that the grievance process had actually cured the fundamental breach that Professor Buckland was complaining about. That was a pretty radical finding, and perhaps not surprisingly, when the case got to the Court of Appeal, the Court of Appeal said, hang on a minute, you can't do that. If there's been a fundamental breach, it can't be cured. Now, again, like everything else, it's easy to sort of put it in those stark terms. The point, though, about grievances, if the grievance stops an issue developing that could otherwise have led to the point at which it can be said there's been that fundamental breach, then I suppose in analysing that, we're not using the term curing the breach, but we're sort of stopping it happening in the first place. So it's important to make that distinction between doing things that take the heat out of the situation and stop the point being reached when a fundamental breach has occurred, because if you've got to that point, then unfortunately there's no turning back in terms of whether or not there's been a constructive dismissal.
Okay, so we can't rewrite history. We can just try and prevent the breach from occurring in the first place. We have guidance on constructive dismissal in the form of a how-to guide that sets out practical guidance on how to protect against claims of constructive dismissal, and further guidance in the termination chapter of the Expert HR Employment Law Manual. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's podcast. Thanks for listening. We're back again next Friday, but until then, it's goodbye from us.